at noon on Saturday. And for those of us who remember that, it was known as Paul Harvey's News and Comment, heard by some 24 million million people each week. And he was very well known for his beginning. "Hello, Americans, this is Paul Harvey. Stand by for news." And he would close with a very customary good day. And in 1976, Paul Harvey began a separate news series that he entitled The Rest of the Story. And in that news feature, it consisted of accounts that were little known or things that were perhaps forgotten. And what made them intriguing was that Harvey had a very great talent of holding back some key element of the story until the very end. And that element would then catch you by surprise, and he would conclude the segment with a very familiar tagline, "And now you know the rest of the story." We come tonight to the final section of the Gideon narrative, and it is here that we find the rest of the story. In spite of his initial problems with fear, his lack of faith, had the Gideon narrative, as we mentioned last Sunday night, had the Gideon narrative ended at Judges chapter 8 and verse 3, he would stand out as one of the greatest leaders in Israel's history. Following his initial call, you remember he was cowering in a wine press, and after that he responds in obedience to God by destroying his father's idols, and on the heels of that he summons the tribes of Manasseh and Asher and Zebulun and Naphtali, and there are some 32,000 men who respond. And yet in spite of that response, he is still unsure and insecure, and he asks God to provide just a couple more signs in the form of a fleece at the end of chapter 6, to which God graciously and patiently responds, and then, interestingly enough, follows that with instruction to Gideon that must have been incredibly challenging to Israel's new leader. "Gideon, I'm sorry, but your army is too big. And if victory comes with that number of soldiers, you're going to think that you're the ones who did it and not me. And so allow anyone who is afraid or trembling to go home," and 22,000 men do just that. The remaining 10,000 are also declared by God to be too many. And so there is a second test that is applied, and it's measured on how they choose to drink water from the spring of Herod, and another 9,700 men are eliminated from Gideon's army. With just 300 soldiers, he will, however, rout the Midianite army with just torches and shouts. He tells them to follow his lead. There, during the changing of the guard at night, his plan is implemented. The jars are shattered. There are the torches that are waved, and his men shout for the Lord and for Gideon, and then they are told to stand still. And in the ensuing chaos, we are told that the Lord set the sword one against the other in chapter 7 and verse 22, and some 120,000 Midianite soldiers fall as a result, chapter 8 and verse 10. The surviving Midianites are on the run. And so the rest of Israel's troops are rallied, including some from the tribe of Ephraim, who are instructed by Gideon to cut off the escapes at the Jordan River. And in the process, they capture two of the Midianite kings and they put them to death. And when they deliver the heads of those two Midianite generals to Gideon, they voice their frustration that he had not included them in the initial call. They feel disrespected. And they contend with him vigorously, according to chapter 8 and verse 1. And yet in response, Gideon demonstrates great tact and diplomacy. He averts further strife among the Israelites in so doing. And yet, as we've said, if the story ended there, Gideon would stand among the greats. As we mentioned last week, there are really two battles that take place. One on the western side of the Jordan River that transpires in Judges 7, and then one that transpires on the eastern side of the Jordan River, what we'll look at tonight in Judges 8. And sadly, it is as though when Gideon steps to the other side of the Jordan River, he becomes an entirely different person. On one side, he finds success by way of divine wisdom and humility and grace. And then when he steps on the other side, it's as though he becomes this forceful, brutal, vengeful individual, as though his success only breeds now greater failure. And that is the rest of the story. In chapter 7, he has done battle God's way. In chapter 8, we see him doing battle man's way. And it begins with the deploying of a vengeful spirit. Let's begin our reading now, picking up in chapter 8 and verse 4. Then Gideon and the 300 men who were with him came to the Jordan and crossed over, weary, yet pursuing. He said to the men of Succoth, "Please give loaves of bread to the people who are following me, for they are weary, and I am pursuing Zeba and Zalmunna, the kings of Midian." The leaders of Succoth said, "Are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna already in your hands that we should give bread to your army?" Gideon said, "All right, when the Lord has given Zeba and Zalmunna into my hand, then I will thrash your bodies with the thorns of the wilderness and with briars." He went up from there to Penuel and spoke similarly to them, and the men of Penuel answered him just as the men of Succoth had answered. So he spoke also to the men of Penuel, saying, "When I return safely, I will tear down this tower." Now Zeba and Zalmunna were in Karkor, and their armies with them, about 15,000 men, all who were left of the entire army of the sons of the east, for the fallen were 120,000 swordsmen. Gideon went up by way of those who lived in the tents on the east of Nobah and Jogbeha, and attacked the camp when the camp was unsuspecting. When Zeba and Zalmunna fled, he pursued them and captured the two kings of Midian, Zeba and Zalmunna, and routed the whole army. Then Gideon, the son of Joash, returned from the battle by the ascent of Harris, and he captured a youth from Succoth and questioned him. Then the youth wrote down for him the princes of Succoth and its elders, 77 men. He came to the men of Succoth, and he said, "Behold, Zeba and Zalmunna, concerning whom you taunted me, saying, 'Are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna already in your hand that we should give bread to your men who are weary?' He took the elders of the city and thorns of the wilderness and briars, and he disciplined the men of Succoth with them. He tore down the tower of Penuel and killed the men of the city." With a frenzied determination, Gideon and his 300 men pursue the fleeing Midianite kings. An interesting phrase there at the end of verse 1. They were weary yet pursuing. They weren't prepared for any kind of a lengthy chase, and so in hunger and exhaustion, they approach some of their countrymen in hopes that their countrymen will provide them with some aid. And yet, the town is unwilling at this point in time to trust that Gideon is going to actually complete the victory. He may have won an amazing battle, but the kings of Midian are still on the loose. They still have a sizable number of troops at their disposal. And so they believe that it's not in their best interest to open themselves up to possible Midianite retaliation by helping Gideon. And at the same time, they express serious doubts that Gideon is actually going to be able to accomplish the mission. Their cynical question literally is, "Are the palms of these kings in your hand?" There was an ancient custom that determined the number of dead bodies by counting the number of hands that had been cut off. And the question that they are in essence asking is, "Have you already defeated the Midianite king so that they are no longer a threat to us?" And simultaneously, they imply their doubt that he can accomplish that mission. Now, while both Succoth and Penuel's refusal is flawed, and though it is certainly faithless, Gideon's threat seems incredibly harsh, especially with the compassionate way, or at least diplomatic way, that he had dealt with the Ephraimites. Along with his threat, he declares that God is going to give the kings into his hands, though there's not been a clear indication of direct involvement on God's part in the second battle as there had been in the first. And it's as though the timidity that we saw in Gideon prior to this point is now non-existent. The tact and the diplomacy that he exercised with the tribe of Ephraim has completely disappeared. And now what we find are demands of support, promises of reprisal in exchange for a refusal. In the first battle, 120,000 Midianite forces fell as Israel blew trumpets, shattered jars, and waved their torches. And now as they do battle against 15,000 troops and two kings, they actually become some semblance of a fighting force. And they set their sights on destroying the ones of Midian who are left. It appears by his own tactical skill, he chooses an approach that the remnants of the Midianite army don't anticipate. There is a surprise attack. There is success. The Midianite army is routed and two kings are captured. And once again, if the narrative ends here, then Gideon stands out in the book of Judges as a man who, though he had a shaky start, became a courageous man of faith. And yet again, it doesn't end here. On his return from battle, Gideon captures a young man from Succoth, and he writes down, it seems, the names of 77 city officials, and he makes good on his previous threat. Verse 16 may seem like a rather quaint phrase, but remember his original threat, to thrash their flesh with thorns and briars. This is a case of Gideon taking the law into his own hands. He becomes the first judge to actually torture his own countrymen in a way that could have easily led to the deaths of those 77 men. And that wouldn't have been all that hard to believe, since that's clearly told to us of what happened when he went to Penuel. That not only does he tear down the tower as he had promised that he would do, but he killed all the men of that city. When Gideon responded to God's call with doubt and fear, God graciously demonstrated patience and compassion. And now Gideon shows none of that to those who, in a sense, are no different than he is in terms of doubt and fear. The second element that we see in terms of a vengeful spirit is with both Zebah and Zalmunna. Look, if you would, beginning in verse 18. And then he said to Zebah and Zalmunna, "What kind of men were they whom you killed at Tabor?" And they said, "They were like you, each one resembling the son of a king." Kind of tuck that back in your mind. The writer here is giving us an indication of where Gideon is heading. "He resembles the son of a king." And he said, "They were my brothers, the son of my mother. As the Lord lives, if only you had let them live, I would not kill you." So he said to Jether, his firstborn, "Rise, kill them." But the youth did not draw his sword, for he was afraid, because he was still a youth. Then Zebah and Zalmunna said, "Rise up yourself and fall on us, for as the man, so is his strength." So Gideon arose and killed Zebah and Zalmunna and took the crescent ornaments which were on their camels' necks. Here we find a tidbit of information that's not been provided to us previous to this. And that is that Gideon viewed these two men as being responsible for the deaths of his brothers. In Judges chapter 6 and 7, we find a fearful young man whose motivation seems to be the fulfilling of God's purpose for him. But in Judges chapter 8, it's as though that motive changes. The determination of his pursuit, the persistence with which he pursues these men is now much more about personal revenge. The initial Gideon was timid and fearful. But now from the testimony of his enemies, we see something of how he has changed, that he possesses the appearance of royalty and strength. In addition to that, the contrast between the old and the new Gideon is stressed further by the reference here to his firstborn son, who is much like his father initially was, and that is faint-hearted when he is first of all given instruction and he refuses to draw the sword. He asks his son to kill both of the kings. Fear prevents him from doing so. The kings are defiant up until the end. They interpret Gideon's instruction to mean that Gideon is afraid to do it himself, that he's looking to pass the buck. And so they prompt him, and Gideon takes their life. As the account of the Midianite kings comes to a close, again, we're given just a hint into something that is less than admirable in Gideon. And that is that he takes the crescent ornaments which were on the camel's neck. And we'll see that he takes some other things that's not mentioned here as well. Those would have been elements perhaps of made of precious metal, and most likely of great worth. It's been said that the measure of a man is what he does with power, and that is certainly going to be true of Gideon, that in the beginning his perception of himself is that he comes from the least tribe, that he is the least important family in that tribe, and that he's the least important person in that family, in that least important tribe. That's his perception. And yet following his overwhelming victory in chapter 7 with ill-equipped troops who have been reduced by 99%, there is an opportunity for power that presents itself, and that presentation is going to leave a sour taste in our mouths as we move forward. It seems that Gideon, while he was able to pass the test of adversity with flying colors, that like many before him and after, failed miserably when it came to the test of prosperity. In verse 22 and going through the end of the chapter, we see here the subtle power, a subtle corruption of power. Verse 22, then the men of Israel said to Gideon, rule over us, both you and your son, also your son's son, for you have delivered us from the hand of Midian. But Gideon said to them, I shall not rule over you, nor shall my son rule over you. The Lord shall rule over you. Yet Gideon said to them, I would request of you that each of you give me an earring from his spoil. For they had gold earrings because they were Ishmaelites. They said, we will surely give them. So they spread out a garment, and every one of them threw an earring there from his spoil. The weight of the gold earrings that he requested was 1,700 shekels of gold, besides the crescent ornaments and the pendants and the purple robes which were on the kings of Midian, and besides the neck bands that were on their camels' necks. Gideon made it into an ephod and placed it in his city, Orpah, and all Israel played the harlot with it there, so that it became a snare to Gideon and his household. So Midian was subdued before the sons of Israel. They did not lift up their heads anymore, and the land was undisturbed for 40 years in the days of Gideon. Then Jerubbabel, the son of Joash, went and lived in his own house. Now Gideon had 70 sons, who were his direct descendants, for he had many wives. His concubine, who was in Shechem, also bore him a son, and he named him Abimelech. And Gideon, the son of Joash, died at a ripe old age and was buried in the tomb of his father Joash in Orpah of the Abiezerites. Then it came about, as soon as Gideon was dead, that the sons of Israel again played the harlot with the Baals and made Baal-berith their god. Thus the sons of Israel did not remember the Lord their God, who had delivered them from the hands of all their enemies on every side, nor did they show kindness to the household of Jerubbabel, that is Gideon, in accord with all the good that he had done to Israel. Such was Israel's gratitude for the deliverance that had been brought, that they not only offer Gideon the throne, they offer him a dynasty. We don't want just you to be king. We want your son to be king over us and your son's son to be king over us. And there's something that is really revealing here in the perspective as they communicate this. You'll notice that they say, rule over us, for you have delivered us. Throughout the narrative, it has been emphasized both directly and indirectly that God is the one who is going to save Israel, that it's not going to be Gideon, and it's certainly not going to be the armies of Israel. And yet, in spite of all of the steps that God has taken to ensure that Israel didn't think it was them, including going from 32,000 men down to 300, God gets seemingly none of the glory. In verse 34, they don't remember the Lord God who delivered them from the hands of their enemies. Now, this would have been quite a temptation for Gideon, wouldn't it? And in his reply, we see a very noble unselfishness. He recognizes that they already have a king and that that king is God. And once again, had the Gideon account ended there, in spite of his weaknesses and his flaws, he would have stand as a judge who faithfully had stood up to God's enemies and who had pointed the people in the direction of the Lord. But that there's that very little and yet powerful word in verse 24. Yet. And that little word, yet, opens a chapter in Gideon's life that is as tragic as the opening chapters have been glorious. This man who has been established as a new leader in Israel now sets one of the most deplorable examples in the entire book. That though Gideon said he didn't want to rule over them, what he has done and what he is about to do communicate the exact opposite of that. Again, it's almost as though when he crosses the river, the Jordan River, he acts more like a king. He brings retribution on those who resist his authority. He takes spoil from the conquered kings. He makes at least what appears on the surface to be a rather simple request. He's verbally rejected their offers of a monarchy, and yet he says, you know what, if I could ask just one favor from you, if you would share the earrings from the spoil, just one for each, from each of you. And by the way, the Ishmaelites and Midianites often in the Old Testament are used interchangeably here. We see the reference here to Ishmaelites. And the spontaneous response of the soldiers is sizable, isn't it? This yields 40 to 45 pounds of gold. And so in a single moment, Gideon goes from being one of the poorest in the nation of Israel to being one of the richest in the people of Israel. The people respond after the battle and they say, hey, you know, why don't you and your sons rule over us? And Gideon's response is, well, you know, I don't want to rule over you. God's going to rule over you. But if you want to show your appreciation, you could make a small donation to my cause. And in making the request and taking some of the spoil, doesn't he validate their initial assessment that he was the one who had delivered them from the hand of the Midianites? And since he had risked his life, since he was the one who had led them to victory, a small donation to offset his personal inconvenience, that wasn't too much to expect, was it? If Gideon's self-indulgent request wasn't bad enough, it's what he does with it that's even worse. It's very reminiscent, isn't it, of what Aaron did with the earrings from the Egyptians. And he formed it into a calf. Here, Gideon takes the gold and he fashions an ephod, a garment that was to be worn by the priest, that contained the breastplate that was to be worn only by the high priest. The original garment was woven with gold. It was made of blue and purple material. There were 12 precious stones that were attached to it that went from his shoulders down to his hips. And some believe that what Gideon was trying to do here was to replicate what the ephod that was at the tabernacle. That he was looking to set himself up as the one through whom people could determine the will of God. And what's especially ironic is that he sets that ephod up in his own hometown, the very place where his judgeship began by his tearing down his father's idols. Instead of Israel now being pulled down because they've adopted the idols of the nations around them, we see a new twist on it, and that is they're sort of, you know, coming up with their own religion. A mixture of the worship of God and elements that were supposed to be connected to the tabernacle, but moving the place and moving the intention. Gideon has no business making this ephod. That's where the ephod was the role of a priest, and he's not from the tribe of Levi. Also, the place where he establishes it was a sin because it wasn't supposed to be in Orpah. It was supposed to be where the tabernacle was. But he seems to use this ephod to bring glory both to himself into his family. And we are told by the writer that the ephod immediately becomes a snare, not just to Gideon, not just to Gideon's family, but all of Israel. That in the beginning, Gideon's story begins with Orpah sort of being the hub of idolatry, but it's more of a family affair. And now, as we get near the end of the Gideon narrative, Orpah again becomes the center, but this time it is for the center of all of Israel and their religious prostitution. Lawson Younger in his commentary said that the final irony of the story is that Gideon, champion of Yahweh against Baal, presides over the national apostasy that after his death will become full-scale Baal worship again. Therefore, Gideon's challenge to Baal has been answered in full, and Gideon himself has contributed significantly to the answer. The name Jerubbaal has acquired an ironic twist. Baal has indeed taken up his own cause with the unknowing participation of his own adversary. In verse 28, we see what was typically the end of one of the six cycles, that the land was undisturbed for 40 years, and in reality, we see as that closes, the seeds being planted for what will be the apostasy on the other side of that passage. The inconsistency of Gideon continues into the epilogue that's provided of his life, that after he sets up the ephod, and he sort of, it seems, retires to private life. He said, you know what, I'm not going to rule over Israel. Or does he? Because once again, he utters the right words. But his actions contradict his message, that though he has verbally declined the monarchy, what he does reveals his craving of honor. He accumulates a sizable harem, a practice of the ancient monarchs. Those wives produce for him 70 sons that are his direct descendants, which would have required considerable resources for someone who is the least in the least tribe with the least family and the least one in that family. And if all of his wives weren't enough, the text tells us that there's a concubine in Shechem who early on in the book of Judges chapter 9 seems to have been a Canaanite woman, and the naming of his son again appears to totally contradict his previous statement about not ruling over Israel. The Bible tells us that Gideon is the one who names him, that literally he appoints his name. And it seems to indicate that this was some kind of a public thing. And so why would a man with numerous wives, 70 sons, a concubine in another town, make such a big deal about naming another child born to him? And it's because the name Abimelech translates, "My father is king." And now even the words that Gideon offers mean something else. The news of Gideon's death and burial recorded in verse 32, and it thus again sets the stage for his successor. It will be Abimelech in a sense, who even though he says he's not going to be a king, it's going to spark a life and death struggle for a non-existent throne with Abimelech. And following his death, Israel returns right back to Baal worship, and we are right back where we started in chapter 6 and verse 1. And it starts all over again. A couple of things, and then we'll wrap up our study tonight. What can we take away from this section of Scripture? First of all, we certainly see the danger of a vengeful attitude throughout the annals of human history and even into the present day. Revenge is one of the most common motivators. It seems that human nature is always on the lookout to set things right when it comes to some insult or some perceived wrong. The problem is that we're sinful, and therefore we usually end up making things worse rather than making things better. The feud between the Hatfields and McCoys, decades long, marked by hatred and death all over an argument about a pig. And whether it's something like that or something else, a spirit of revenge is no more justified in us than it was in Gideon. God called him to deliver Israel from the Midianites, and not to exact revenge on kings who killed his brother, not to enact reprisals on those who refused to help from his own countrymen. But when we make a decision to trust God, it means not just trusting Him for our spiritual deliverance, it also means trusting Him to set things right. And that's the very thing that Paul encourages us to do, instructs us to do in Romans chapter 12 and verses 17 down through verse 21. So much as it depends on us to be at peace with all men, to not take vengeance for ourselves, but rather to let God be the one who takes the vengeance. And then the second thing we learn from him is that our lifestyle has to match our language. Much of what Gideon says in this chapter is admirable. The problem is that he didn't follow it up with how he lived. That what he went on to do, in many ways, destroyed any element of legitimacy to what he said. To Israel's suggestion, he claimed that he didn't want to be king because God was their king, and yet he turned around and he lived as though he was one. On the surface, he appears to overcome the temptation that was put before him, but the reality is that he simply succumbed to a subtler form of the same temptation. And as a result, God is robbed of the glory that was due to him. The nation of Israel is led in the opposite direction that God wanted them to go. And that is well documented if you were to read on into Judges chapter 9. We need to take away from this the fact that it is possible for us to have all of our theological T's crossed and our I's dotted and to still live as hypocrites. And to realize that few things turn as many people away from Jesus Christ as pretense in the lives of those who claim to be his disciples. Now, sin will certainly happen, but we must exercise extreme caution to ensure that our sin doesn't lead someone else astray. People in 2015 can come up with more than enough reasons not to be a Christian. We don't need to give them another one. As we live, we need to be cognizant of our mission to honor and to glorify God, the one that we serve, and to do that by making sure that our words match our walk, that our beliefs are validated by our behavior, that our creed is reflected in our conduct. And if not, then we become like Gideon. Though we say all of the right words, our actions destroy anything, any power of what we have said. Tonight, do you need to be a servant of God? To follow at least in part of what Gideon was, who initially obeyed God, who was faithful to God. And to continue that throughout your life. The sad thing about Gideon is that he follows in the footsteps of many of God's leaders. And that is, there are very few of them in the Bible that actually started and finished strong. Be different from that. We need to be different from that. To not just start, not just somewhere in the middle, but completely and consistently so that we finish strong.